All right. I want to pick up where we left off in the book of Jeremiah. We left off in chapter 52, and Lord willing, we're going to be able to finish this book up tonight. I think what's kind of interesting is this chapter 52 of Jeremiah kind of goes hand in glove. It's almost a duplicate of what we read when we went through 2 Kings chapter 24. And I think what's kind of also significant, if you just look at basically the last sentence of chapter 51, where we read about basically how God was going to destroy Babylon in that chapter 51, in verse 64 it says, thus far are the words of Jeremiah. So people don't know if Jeremiah wrote this or not. I assume that if he didn't, then obviously maybe his sidekick Brock did, but I think he did write this. It's just that they put it here at the very end, I think, because it's just kind of reiterates the fall of Jerusalem. And I think that God repeats himself for emphasis, because this account we can find in other places as well as 2 Chronicles and 2 Kings. We find it here in Jeremiah more than once. So I think God really wanted to emphasize this destruction of this Jerusalem, because people, I think, so often, if they claim to believe in God, the God of the Bible, the God of heaven, it's just so easy to just assume that God would never bring any kind of judgment against his people. And I think the church is in that kind of same situation today, where the church is really becoming polluted in terms of the world and the flesh and the devil and everything else. But there's so many people inside the church who just kind of have this false sense of security, just like they did during Jeremiah's day, that God would never judge his church, that he would never judge his people, he'd never judge Israel, he'd never judge Judah. I mean, people do this all the time. So I think that's why God really emphasizes the fall of Jerusalem, the destruction of this city that was once God's city. I mean, that's where he put his temple, and that's where he dwelt among his people. And, I think that's why he really wanted to emphasize this, because I think time and time and time again, you can see where history just repeats itself, where people just take God for granted, they take their salvation for granted, they take their eternal destiny for granted, they take everything for granted, and then they're just basically living like hell and think they're going to somehow get away with it. Well, I think that's why we can read the fall of Jerusalem over and over again. But it does give us a little bit more detail, and some of the detail as far as the numbers are concerned, it's a little bit confusing. I don't think that they're contradictory. I just think it's just confusing, because going through this book of Jeremiah, I pointed out that there was at least 3 deportations that took place, and there was a number of people that were basically exiled in each one of these deportations, and I think that can get kind of confusing as far as some of these numbers. But let's just go ahead and break this down, beginning with that verse 1 of chapter 52 of Jeremiah. It says this: Zedekiah was 21 years old when he became king, and he reigned 11 years in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Hamutal, the daughter of Jeremiah of Libna. He did evil in the sight of the Lord, like all that Jehoiakim had done, for through the anger of the Lord this came about in Jerusalem and Judah, until he cast them out from his presence, and Zedekiah rebelled against the king of Babylon. Now it came about in the 9th year of his reign, on the 10th day of the 10th month, that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came, and he and all his army against Jerusalem, and camped against it, and built the siege wall around it. Now, just keep this in mind. With Zedekiah, it was Nebuchadnezzar. He basically came down there and overran Jerusalem in 608 B.C., and then he did it again in 597 B.C., and then in 586 B.C., this is the final destruction of Jerusalem. But what happened there was you had Jehoiakim, and he was a son of Josiah, and so was Zedekiah. He was a son of Josiah, and Josiah was a very godly king. I mean, he was one of the most godly kings in Israel's history. But then he gets some kind of worthless sons that I think, what does that tell you? In other words, you wonder how You know, you can have such a godly father and end up with a son who just basically is a rebel. Well, you know, it all boils down to freedom of choice, but also too, they mention his mother here, Amutal, which could have something to do with it in terms of his, basically his rebellion against the Lord. It says here that he did evil in the sight of the Lord. I mean, Zedekiah to me just reminds me of Herod. He just reminds me of a man who was always vacillating between wanting to do what God told him to do or would tell him to do and wanting to do what his advisors would tell him to do. He never had any backbone whatsoever. And I think that that was really his undoing. But when it says here, yet he did evil in the sight of the Lord, I think it's kind of significant, because what happened there was that this Jehoiakim, he actually rebelled against Nebuchadnezzar, and Nebuchadnezzar took his army and he was marching against Jerusalem, and before he got to Jerusalem, Jehoiakim died. And so Jehoiakim's son, Jehoiachin, took the throne. He only reigned like 3 months, and Nebuchadnezzar gets down there, and Jehoiachin just surrendered. He opened the doors of Jerusalem, surrendered to Nebuchadnezzar. Then Nebuchadnezzar just hauled him off to Babylon, and Nebuchadnezzar put this Zedekiah as a vassal king, and Zedekiah's real name was Mattaniah. But Nebuchadnezzar changed it to Zedekiah. Anyway, it can get kind of confusing, but the point is, I think, when you look at what's happened here, I think it's also kind of interesting about this Jehoiachin. He was only 18 years old. He only reigned like 3 months. They hauled him off to Babylon. And what's interesting, we're going to read it here, they're basically the last couple of verses in this chapter 52, that he's in prison there year after year, and year after year. But then after Nebuchadnezzar dies, then another king takes him out of prison, gives him a stipend, he's able to eat at the king's table, and he's honored the rest of his days. And that's the line through which Jesus Christ comes through. So even though it looks like the end or the destruction of Jerusalem, of God's people, of God's promises, of the Messiah, is still going to fulfill his word. So when he says here in that verse 2 of chapter 52 of Jeremiah, he did evil in the sight of the Lord, like all that Jehoiakim had done. And to me, that's his epitaph. I think it really says a lot in this regard, is that we are all going to have an epitaph when we die. And it doesn't matter what men say about us. It's what really matters is what God says about us in the end. And what really matters is what heaven says about us. What really matters is what heaven puts on our tombstone. I mean, people can be some of the most wicked wretches in history, and men are going to exalt them in their death, you know what I'm saying, and give them these magnificent funerals and just really honor them. And they could be very well be in hell, you know what I'm saying? So, I mean, you know, what really matters is in the sight of God. Because I'm sure if you stuck a microphone in Zedekiah's face and said, are you doing evil in the sight of the Lord? He would have said no, but according to God, he did evil in the sight of the Lord. And at verse 3, it says, for through the anger of the Lord, this came about in Jerusalem and Judah until he cast them out from his presence, and Zedekiah rebelled against the king of Babylon. Now, what happened there was Zedekiah, he decided, you know, I'm going to rebel against this king. I'm no longer going to pay taxes. I'm no longer going to be a vassal to him. And he put all his trust, he put all his hope in the king of Egypt, or the Pharaoh of Egypt. He figured, well, I'll just align myself with Egypt, and I'll just break off the yoke of Nebuchadnezzar from Babylon. And in doing that, what he was really doing is this. He wasn't putting his faith, his trust in God. He was putting his faith and his trust in Egypt, of all people. And, you know, we see this today. We're having all kinds of problems. I mean, our problems are innumerable in this country, and they're unsolvable. Just pick up tomorrow's paper, and you will just read one disastrous thing after another, especially in regards to our economy. But are people looking to God? Are they looking to God in prayer? Are they seeking his face? No, they're looking for the government to solve these problems. Just like Zedekiah, you know, instead of looking to God, instead of listening to God, he just figured, well, I'll get out of this mess. I'll just go to Egypt. He's just a rebel. And I just see it in this country. I mean, people are just rebels because they don't turn to God. They don't repent of their sins. They don't look to him. You know, they look to the government to solve all their problems, and the government can't solve anything. And in verse 4 it says, now it came about in the ninth year of his reign, on the tenth day of the tenth month, that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came, and he and all his army against Jerusalem, and camped against it, and built a siege wall around it. Now, This is what happened when Nebuchadnezzar came down there. That city was under siege for 18 months, almost 2 years, before it finally fell. And Josephus, he's a Jewish historian around the first century, he basically said that the reason they were able to hold out so long against the Babylonians is because they had a lot of different kind of weaponry for defending the city that was almost high tech, if that's the word I want to use, in terms of holding off this siege. But then famine begins to set in. As a matter of fact, when we get into the book of Lamentations, we're going to read, I think it's chapter 4, where we're going to read how people were so hungry at that time that the cannibalism actually set in. I mean, this is the kind of judgment that God brought against these people. And it says, verse 5, it says, "So the city was under siege until the 11th year of King Zedekiah. On the 9th day of the 4th month, the famine was so severe in the city that there was no food for the people of the land." Now, see, all this time, Jeremiah was telling the people, he was telling Zedekiah when this Jerusalem was under siege, he's saying, listen, God is telling you that you need to surrender. If you would just surrender, open up those doors, walk out with your hands up, you will spare your life. You'll save your life. You know, you're going to end up going to Babylon, but you'll spare your life. And then Zedekiah, he had a bunch of worthless, good-for-nothing advisors who were telling him, no, Jeremiah is a traitor. That's treasonous. Don't do that. We can depend on Egypt. They're going to bail us out of this mess. They're going to overrun Nebuchadnezzar. So you see a situation where these people really were not listening to God. They had no intention of obeying God. And so things really went from bad to worse. Look at how things are going from bad to worse in this country. And regardless of how bad things get, it just doesn't seem like we're just moved. We're not moved spiritually. We're not moved to get down on our knees and humble ourselves and pray and seek God's face and turn from our wicked ways. We're not about to do that. So that's exactly the way these people got, until they got so desperate that cannibalism set in. And at verse 7 it says, "Then the city was broken into, and all the men of war fled and went out from the city at night by way of the gate between the two walls, which was by the king's garden, though the Chaldeans were all around the city. And they went by the way of the Araba, but the army of the Chaldeans pursued the king and overtook Zedekiah in the plains of Jericho, and all the army was scattered from him. And then they captured the king and brought him up to the king of Babylon at Riblah in the land of Hamath, and he passed sentence on him. And the king of Babylon slaughtered the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes, and he also slaughtered all the princes of Judah in Riblah. Then he blinded the eyes of Zedekiah, the king of Babylon, and bound him with bronze fetters, and brought him to Babylon, and put him in prison until the day of his death." Now, that's the end of the southern tribe here, and it really ends in disaster for this King Zedekiah, because he just would not listen to what God was trying to tell him through his prophet Jeremiah. But it's kind of interesting to me, because when things really got desperate, what did these leaders do? What did Zedekiah do? What did his men do? It's like they just leave everybody and they dig a hole through the wall at night and they all take off running. They leave the people behind. This is the kind of leadership that they have, you see? And this is the kind of leadership that we have in this country today, right? The type of leadership that we are cursed with today, these people really do not care for the well-being of this nation or the well-being of individuals. All you have to do is just pick up the paper and read it. It's just absolutely outrageous. I mean, how they would just continue to just, suck off the taxpayer and destroy the hardworking people in order to promote themselves. We just read this all the time. Well, you see the same thing. I mean, history doesn't change. Human nature doesn't change. You know, when things got bad enough, these guys just deserted. These guys just deserted the city. They deserted the people. They went off. They took off running. That's everybody out there to die, right? I mean, that's the kind of leadership they had. But here's the interesting thing. In that verse 8, it says, "But the army, the Chaldeans, pursued the king and overtook Zedekiah in the plains of Jericho. And all his army was scattered from him, and they captured the king and brought him to the king of Babylon at Riblah in the land of Hamath, and he passed sentence on him." So Nebuchadnezzar was up there towards Damascus. He was up north. And when they captured Zedekiah, they captured him, and they captured a number of his advisors, politicians. They dragged him up there to Nebuchadnezzar, and I think it's kind of interesting. In this verse 10, it says, the king of Babylon slaughtered the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes, and he also slaughtered all the princes of Judah and Riblah. And if I'm not mistaken, I think Zedekiah had two sons, and that's the last thing he saw was Nebuchadnezzar had his two sons killed. And then look what that verse 11, then he blinded the eyes of Zedekiah, the king of Babylon, and bound him with bronze fetters and brought him to Babylon and put him in prison until the day of his death. And you know what's kind of interesting? I know I shared this before when we went through another account, was that Josephus had mentioned what took place there when Zedekiah had his eyes gouged out. It was Ezekiel. He was already in Babylon, and Ezekiel was writing to King Zedekiah from Babylon, and he was telling him everything that Jeremiah was telling him, only the two of them were in disagreement in regards to what they were saying about Zedekiah. But it's interesting because in this book of Josephus, it says this, it happened that the two prophets agreed with one another in what they said, as well as all the other things, that the city should be taken and Zedekiah himself should be taken captive. But Ezekiel disagreed with him, or disagreed with Jeremiah, and said that Zedekiah should not see Babylon, while Jeremiah said to him that the king of Babylon should carry him away thither to in bonds. And because they did not both say the same thing as to this circumstance, he disbelieved what they both appeared to agree in, and condemned them as not speaking the truth therein, although all these things foretold did come to pass according to the prophecies. And that's very interesting to me, because Ezekiel was writing to Zedekiah and he's saying, you won't see Babylon, but Jeremiah says you're going to Babylon. And so they were both dead on, because he was dragged off to Babylon and there he died. I don't know if he died of old age, if he died of sickness, or he died there, or they executed him over there. But the thing is, when he got to Babylon, he couldn't see Babylon, right? He never saw Babylon because they gouged out his eyes. I mean, that's quite a judgment. And I think there's a poetic justice to that too. Why do you think I say that in terms of Zedekiah losing his sight?
He refused to see the truth of what Jeremiah was saying. Yeah. So what more important eyesight than spiritual eyesight?
Yeah. And Jesus Christ dealt with the same kind of thing in his generation. You know, when he was here, he was just saying that he's come to make the blind seeing and the seeing blind. When people refuse to look at the truth for what it is and believe the truth, how many times did Jesus say, he who has an ear to hear, let him hear? Well, same thing. If we've got eyes to see, man, if we refuse to see what God is saying, then, you know, in a sense, the judgment is, then we're not going to see it all. You wonder how come people can't see what's right in front of their face today. They're just almost blinded to the judgments that are happening all around them because they refuse to see the truth. Exactly what happened to the Zedekiah. And then he says in that verse 11, then he blinded the eyes of Zedekiah, and the king of Babylon bound him with bronze fetters. Now, what does bronze symbolize in the scripture?
That's what the altar where they did the burnt offering was made of, was bronze.
Yeah, it always points to judgment. That's why he says he bound him with bronze fetters. I think that that too is very powerful in his symbolism. I mean, it's showing this is purely a judgment from God against this man and against these people. He says he bound him with bronze fetters and brought him to Babylon and put him in prison until the day of his death. Like I said, we don't know how he died. He may have been executed there, or he just simply died of old age, or, you know, died of disease or whatever. But he met a terrible end because he wouldn't listen to God. And I'm telling you, man, that this is given to us for our instruction. And look at how many people who are running this country today will not listen to God. And they got a judgment coming that you won't believe. In verse 12, it says, now on the 10th day of the 5th month, which was the 19th year of the king Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the bodyguard, who was in the service of the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem, and he burned the house of the Lord, the king's house, and all the houses of Jerusalem, even every large house he burned with fire. So all the army of the Chaldeans who were with the captain of the guard broke down all the walls around Jerusalem. Then Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, carried away into exile some of the poor of the people and the rest of the people who were left in the city, and the deserters who had deserted to the king of Babylon, and the rest of the artisans. And now, this is a situation where it's exactly what Jeremiah had predicted. that then Nebuchadnezzar's general, he went down to Jerusalem and just tore down the walls. He tore down the houses and set fire to them. He confiscated all the wealth and just destroyed, completely destroyed the city itself. And the city just laid in ruins for decades, and it's just, you know, was occupied by squatters and people who were just almost like homeless, right? The whole city was just burned out and destroyed. And I think it says a lot that God's temple was completely destroyed, completely demolished. The temple of Solomon that he had built, this is what the people put their faith in. They put their trust in. They figured, hey, man, we're in tight with the God of heaven. I don't care what Jeremiah says. We don't need to change. Well, that could give people a very false sense of security. And I think one of the things that can give a person a real false sense of security, because I see it all the time, I hear it all the time, is that people can be living in just total opposition to God's moral laws, but they will say something like, well, I pray. You ever hear people say stuff like that? Well, I pray. You know, I even had an atheist tell me that one day. Well, I prayed last night. I said, prayed last night? Who'd you pray to? I mean, see, this could give people this false sense of security. This would be like, well, me and God are tight because I pray. You know, I mean, these people prayed, believe me, they were very religious, but if we're not going to be obeying God, then we got a judgment coming, and that's what happened to this whole city, and it was completely and utterly destroyed. And then it says here in that verse 16, it says, but Nebuchadnezzar, the captain of the guard, left some of the poorest of the land to be vine dressers and plowmen. Now, you know, that was a good move, a good administrative move, because some of the people of the land, they were uneducated, they were poor, and then Nebuchadnezzar just felt like, well, these people are just going to be a drain on me. They're going to go to Babylon, and they're just going to you know, be on some kind of public assistance. So he just figured, well, I'll just put them to work, and then I'll just tax them. You know what I'm saying? And verse 17, now the bronze pillars which belonged to the house of the Lord, and the stands and the bronze sea which were in the house of the Lord, the Chaldeans broke in pieces and carried all their bronze to Babylon. They also took away the pots and the shovels and the snuffers and the basins and the pans and all the bronze vessels which were used in the temple service. The captain of the guard also took away the bowls of the fire pans and the basins and the pots and the lampstands and the pans and the drink offering bowls, what was fine gold and what was fine silver. The two pillars, the one sea, and the 12 bronze bulls that were under the sea, and all the stands which King Solomon had made for the house of the Lord, the bronze of all these vessels was beyond weight. As for the pillars, the height of each pillar was 18 cubits, and it was 12 cubits in circumference and 4 fingers in thickness and hollow. Now a capital of bronze was on it, and the height of each capital was 5 cubits, with networks and pomegranates upon the capital all around, all of bronze, and the second pillar was like these, including pomegranates. There were 96 exposed pomegranates. All the pomegranates numbered 100 on the network all around. Now, before we go any further, we read all about this. We read about in Kings when Solomon was having this temple built. It took like 7 years to have it built. We read all about these bronze pillars that they, one was named Jason, the other was named Boaz, and they were put right there at the entrance to the temple. They were made of this bronze, and also Solomon had these craftsmen make this this sea, this levir. It was referred to as the bronze sea or the molten sea. And it was just enormous, and it was made of bronze. I mean, you know, they busted all these things up, and the weight was beyond measure in terms of how much all this weighed. But it was extremely valuable, even though it was bronze. It wasn't silver or gold, but it was in such a massive quantity that, you know, they just completely took everything of any value whatsoever. Even these huge, massive things, they just busted them up and carted them away. I mean, it should really speak to people. I mean, it really should. It should have spoken to people back then. I think it did, but it was way too late then when they realized that, you know what? That's our temple. We put all our faith and our trust in that. All right? How many people do that today in the sense that they may put all their faith and their trust in their denomination, or that they go to a particular church when they're not really living for God and they're not really committed to God? Well, that's what happened to these people in the end. They just saw all this tremendous wealth and things that they put so much, I guess, emphasis on. It was all destroyed, all carried away. And you, when you read this, I think it's kind of interesting. It doesn't just come out and say, well, Nebuchadnezzar carved away all the bronze that made up the pillars and the laver and the molten sea. No, it even goes as far as to tell you, you know, the height, the thickness, and the circumference. And then in that verse 22, now a capital of bronze was on it, and the height of each capital was 5 cubits, with networks and pomegranates upon the capitals all around, all of bronze. And the second pillar is like these, including pomegranates. It even mentions the design of these, the capital of these bronze pillars that stood at the entrance of the threshold of the temple. And I think even that is kind of significant, because it mentions here twice, at least twice, about the pomegranates that went all the way around these capitals. Because what do pomegranates really point to spiritually speaking?
The works, the fruit.
Yeah, fruitfulness, or being fruitful, right? Because you could open a pomegranate, and of course it's filled with hundreds of seeds. And it's almost like these people were not spiritually fruitful in their lives. And I think that that's what really, that's why this is really broken down the way it is, because I think the Bible makes it abundantly clear, Jesus Christ made it abundantly clear, that we really do need to produce fruit in our Christian walk. I think that the man woman read in the Gospels where he came up to a fig tree one morning and to have some breakfast, and there were no figs on it, so he just cursed that tree and it just completely withered and died. And his apostles were blown away by that miracle. And I don't think that Jesus was just, you know, ticked off. I think that he was trying to use that as an object lesson to say, hey, man, people can be very, very religious. Like this tree, it was full of leaves, but it had no fruit. But that fig tree, it almost symbolized Israel, that Israel was very religious, but it had no fruit. And we could be the same way. We could be very religious and have no fruit. So when it's talking about these pomegranates here, I think there's a spiritual application that could be made from that, because he just doesn't break it down as far as he took all the bronze. No, he describes it for us, breaks it down for us. And then verse 23, it says,
John, before you continue on, it almost sounds like God is going out of his way to describe the intricacies, the beauty of this thing. So you kind of see the heart of God, I think. And
right.
He knows and is intimate with this.
Right,
and
right.
And hates to, even though it's got to be done, it doesn't escape him.
Right. No, that's a good point. I mean, that's why I think it's gone through such detail here in describing what these pillars look like and the molten sea and all the rest of it, because I think that people, they took these things for granted, and now they're gone. And in verse 24 it says, then the captain of the guard took Sariah, the chief of the priest, and Zephaniah, the second priest, with the three officers of the temple. And he also took from the city one official who was the overseer of the men of war, and seven of the king's advisors who were found in the city, and the scribe of the commander of the army who mustered the people of the land, and 60 men of the people of the land who were found in the midst of the city. And Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, took them and brought them to the king of Babylon at Riblah. Then the king of Babylon struck them down and put them to death at Riblah in the land of Hamath. So Judah was led away into exile from its land. In other words, it's breaking this down for us too, as far as the basically the administrators, the politicians, the princes, the people who were in charge, they get hauled off and they get executed. All right? And I'm telling you right now, man, I mean, you look at the kind of leadership that we have today, and it's really running this country into the ground, and they got a judgment for them coming, because it was Jesus Christ who said, whoever has been given much, much is going to be required of you. And it also says in James, don't all of you become teacher, brethren, because as such, you're going to incur a much stricter judgment. And I really do believe that people who are in positions of leadership, political or religious, they're going to have a much stricter judgment than the rest of the people. They really are, because they are in positions of leadership. And these guys, you know, now get theirs. And then that verse 28 says, these are the people whom Nebuchadnezzar carried away into exile. In the seventh year, 3,023 Jews. In the 18th year of Nebuchadnezzar, 832 persons from Jerusalem. And in the 23rd year of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, carried into exile 745 Jewish people. There were 4,600 persons in all. When you read this, it is confusing. And I don't think that there's a contradiction here. I think it is confusing because, like I said, there were several different deportations. And when you read And for example, 2 Kings chapter 24, when we went through that, this is what it says in regards to one of the deportations. It says, at that time, the servants of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, went up to Jerusalem, and the city came under siege. And Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, came to the city while his servants were besieging it. And Jehoiachin, the king of Judah, went out to the king of Babylon, and he and his mother and his servants and his captains and his officials. So the king of Babylon took him captive in the 8th year of his reign. So it's in the 8th year of his reign. This is what it's saying here. He carried out from there all the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house, and cut them in pieces, all the vessels of gold which Solomon king of Israel had made in the temple of the Lord, just as the Lord had said. Then he led away into exile all Jerusalem and all the captains and all the mighty men of valor, 10,000 captives and all the craftsmen, and dismissed. None remained except the poorest people in the land. Now, that's what I'm saying. When you read these different accounts, you can see that this is under different deportations. Now, this talked about a deportation in the 8th year of King Nebuchadnezzar's reign, and this over here is talking about his 7th year and the 18th year and the 23rd year. So like I'm saying, if you combine all these together, obviously there was a lot more than just 4,600 people. But they're not using all the deportations that were involved here in this chapter 52 of Jeremiah. So that's why I'm thinking that, well, there's more than just this 4,600 persons in all, because this isn't including all the deportations, all right? That looks pretty obvious to me. But I think what's also very significant is they took from the temple more than once. I just read it there in this chapter 24 of 2 Kings, is that they took all kinds of utensils and pots and pans, and they took the bowls and the cups from the temple. And I think the last time that we read about these was when we read through, I think, the 5th chapter of the book of Daniel. They had all these things warehoused and stored in Babylon for decades, and then the night that Babylon was overthrown by the Medes and the Persians, that's when they took out all these gold cups and all these pots and pans and whatnot, and they were drinking, you know, having this big bash and this worshiping and toasting the gods of gold and silver and bronze and steel and wood and all of these material things. And they were just insulting the God of heaven. And that's when that hand came out and wrote on the wall, "Meeny, meeny, take care of a parson," you know. And, of course, Daniel would interpret that, mean that, hey, man, this night your kingdom has been divided and is given over to the Medes and the Persians, and you've been weighed in the balance and found wanting. Well, I think that's kind of interesting that they took all this very valuable stuff, and they just warehoused it in Jerusalem, or excuse me, they warehoused it in Babylon until decades later they brought it out to insult God, and then that was when Babylon was overthrown. Now, just winding this down, this verse 31 says, "Now it came about in the 37th year, the exile of Jehoiachin, king of Judah, in the 12th month, on the 25th of the month, that evil Merodach, the king of Babylon, in the first year of his reign, showed favor to Jehoiachin, king of Judah, and brought him out of prison. Then he spoke kindly to him and set his throne above the thrones of the kings who were with him in Babylon. So Jehoiachin changed his prison clothes and had his meals in the king's presence regularly all the days of his life. For his allowance, a regular allowance was given to him by the king of Babylon, a daily portion all the days of his life until the day of his death." Now, I think that's kind of interesting because, like I was talking about this Jehoiachin, he also was known as Jeconias or Jeconia or Jeconia or Konia. I mean, his name was pronounced and spelled in different ways, whether it's in the book of Jeremiah or the book of Kings or whatever. But what's interesting is that if you look at this guy, he was the one to whom the line of Christ was preserved. This king, he was only 18 years old when he was taken to Babylon, and he was there like for 36 years, and then he finally got out of prison. But I think it's kind of interesting because if you follow his line, you know, from the line of Solomon all the way down, Jehoiachin, his son was Salathiel, and he, Salathiel's son was Zerubbabel. And then it goes all the way down to Joseph, who was the husband of Mary. But then if you follow Mary's line, she comes through King David through another son, by the name of Nathan. So you see a situation here that even though it looks so bleak and so black and there's no hope for God's people anymore, God does not forget his promise, because we were just reading right here this last couple of verses about this evil Merodach. He came to the throne, and I guess God moved his heart, because it says right here in that verse 32, then he spoke kindly to him. He spoke kindly to this Jehoiachin. He was the one who was going to, God was going to use to still keep his promise in regards to Jesus Christ coming through the Jews. In other words, everything seems to be pitch black, but way, way, way off in the distance, there's this flicker of light that you can read right here in these last three or four verses in regards to what happens to this man, because it's through his line that Jesus Christ ends up coming through in terms of his legal title to the throne through Joseph and Mary, because they both come from royal blood. They both come from the line of David, one through the line of Nathan and the other one through the line of Solomon. And Joseph comes through the line of Solomon. In other words, Jesus Christ is the legal heir to the throne. And then through Mary, he gets his humanity. Anybody have want to add or share to what we read in regards to this Jeremiah? There's been 52 chapters, and I tell you, it's been very, very tough going in terms of virtually all of it has been gloom and doom and judgment. That's all, the whole thing, from virtually start to finish. And now, starting next week, Lord willing, we're going to get into the Book of Lamentations, and that's going to be more gloom and doom, and basically you're going to see how Jeremiah just pours his heart out to God as far as, you know, looking at what happened to these people. And in other words, you can really see the heart of God through Jeremiah. It's not that God was just totally indifferent to what happened to his people as far as the destruction of Jerusalem and these people being killed by the sword and by famine and by disease, and then the survivors being hauled off into captivity. God was just dealing with them. But God is faithful. That's the thing. You can really see this through Jeremiah, that in spite of the fact that now their whole history looks like it's finished and it's through and it's over and it's done, there's a flicker of light there that we just read here in regards to this Jehoiachin, that it's going to be through him, that God's going to keep his promise still. Anyway, anybody ever want to add or share? All right, let's go ahead and close it. But Lord, we just look to you in prayer. I'd like to thank you for giving us the opportunity to read this book of Jeremiah. You know, he was quite a prophet. He went through just so much for your namesake, and he was so persecuted and hated and vilified, and he was just tormented with all kinds of insults and imprisonment, and put him in stocks, and the poor guy was just abused year after year after year, but he was faithful, and we thank you for this prophet. And I just really do pray that in spite of myself, that you know, this could be used as a resource for your glory, for your honor, that people can log on there and listen to the book of Jeremiah, that you would help Kevin in editing it, and that it would go forth and produce much fruit. And we just thank you, we got through another book. In Jesus' name we pray, amen. Mm-hmm.